Yeah, Richard, you know what I find amusing is that somehow you didn't say you hadn't watched The Sopranos. You were just sitting there like, maybe I should watch it.
No idea how angry my boss gets, and more every year. Now he's like at a simmering, boiling rage, but I do not watch anything past 1985.
Oh,
he's like,
right.
You have to watch, you have not seen Breaking Bad. No, well, am I going to watch Breaking Bad? He's like, you've got to watch this stuff.
I get that all the time about Breaking Bad, and I get it about The Wire. I bought the complete Wire on DVD, and then a friend borrowed it as soon as I got it, like the same day, and then she and her husband moved to California and took the DVD box set with them.
Do you want me to find them?
I mean, they do work in the film industry.
Well, there you go.
What are their names?
Do they have SAG credits? Are they part of the guilds?
I'm trying to remember. I think Jenny. I think Jenny might work with Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow.
I think.
Never heard of them. What do they do? Ruin movies for everybody?
And television.
It's funny.
I still don't understand how to use that site. I haven't tried all that much.
Does anyone give a fuck Rotten Tomatoes anymore? It's funny. They used to have the Rotten Tomatoes score on everything, and I think they're like moving away from it, which is good, because like who actually cares about an aggregator site? Because it's a fucking aggregator site. It aggregates the reviews. It doesn't create its own goddamn reviews. Holy
I just
shit.
Don't understand.
No, people do care because that's Yelp.
Well, it is essentially what people want from the news. It's a headline. It's no information, nothing substantive, just a little blurb.
General thing. It's like if you went on to Rotten Tomatoes, for instance, and the new Bond movie was at 75, you'd go, "Oh, this has got to be terrible."
Because
it's like you just want to know quickly. You want to go and see if something's like, oh shit, Malignant's at 17%. No.
But 70, if it got a C, that's a 75%. That's 3 out of 4 people like that.
And isn't it, what is it?
No,
it's over
no,
75
but it's, but,
and it's fresh or over 60 and it's
no,
fresh?
No, but again, if you've got a big genre, I'm not in a big genre, big franchise movie. Big franchise movie comes out and it's less than 88. That's like people hate this.
That's Suicide Squad. The first
one. Am I wrong?
No, I mean, that was the whole thing. People lambasted, like, all those I mean, you work for DC, so, like, you get it. Like, they lambasted those movies because of their Rotten Tomatoes score, which, by the way, if you can't have a conversation with someone about why you don't like a movie and the only thing you can mention is it had a low Rotten Tomatoes score, what the fuck are you basing any of this on, then? It's just...
Okay, but it's like, it goes back to my original very compelling point of...
He's gunning for a job, guys.
These franchise movies, I mean, talk about that knows what is expected of it and is bending over backwards to deliver. So when these big franchise tentpole Marvel movie, Star Wars movie, James Bond movie, if they're not in the 90% zone... Something has gone wrong. Suddenly you've got a solo story or something. And I don't know. I didn't see it. Maybe
that's
great.
Or literally Suicide Squad, Justice League.
Or Suicide Squad. Or it's like, wait, what? Like, okay, fans are rejecting this. Now, if I'm not a fan, I'm just a regular person. That, like, oh, shit. Maybe I shouldn't bother. If the fans hate it. Now, that's not necessarily logical, but that is how people think.
It's unfortunate, is the way I look at it. I know you agree. Like, the fact that for some reason a score on a website determines my need or want to do something or watch a medium is just kind of counterintuitive to enjoying things in general.
Well, it totally is.
A buddy of mine once asked me for a recommendation of a movie, and so I gave it to him, and he went to Rotten Tomatoes, and I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm seeing if other people like it, and I'm like, I just told you I like it. Why do you have to check consensus of the rest of the world?
Like, you know, Cullen, when you say you like it, now it's like, let me see what normal people think.
And I guess that's maybe
Cullen,
that's
Cullen's
what it was.
Over here. I gotta go. And then I gotta go over Cullen's over here, the rest of humanity's over here. I'm going to be somewhere, then you know. See, everyone's got their own, you know.
I don't get it. If Cullen told me to watch something, I would watch it. And you know how I know that? Because on this episode of the Culture Cast, we're talking about a movie that Cullen suggested we watch. What movie is that, Richard?
The Seventh Victim.
Yeah. Which, hey, you know what? It has a 94% on Rotten Tomatoes, 63% audience score. There was a time on this podcast, I think before both of y'all times, maybe not Richard, but definitely Cullen, where I used to trot the Rotten Tomatoes scores out. Were you around for that, Richard?
I vaguely recall that, right. But I don't know. I'm usually drunk when I do these.
You and me both. Well, not drunk, but you know what I mean. Richard, salute. Salute, as they would say.
Salute.
I got my can of seltzer.
I went downstairs to grab that board game and I forgot to grab a drink. So, hey, you know what? We're doing this one sober.
I had a scissors in my hand. I struck at him. I ran away. He was lying in the hall. Blood around him.
Your sister, Mary, is a murderess.
I don't believe it.
You go back to school, then forget Chocolate.
Drink it, Jacqueline. There's nothing else for you to do. They say you've got to die.
Okay, I have a question, Cullen, before we get to the movie proper.
Mm-hmm.
You told us why you picked it, you know, before we watched it.
Yeah.
But why did you pick The Seventh Victim?
Well, because Richard had suggested doing a Val Lewton movie. And I thought that was a great suggestion because I love Val Lewton movies. And to my knowledge, y'all hadn't seen any of them. And this is a personal favorite. Cat People and The Leopard Man are more famous. This one is just a little more unsettling. It's a little more quiet, but also disquieting. It stays with me more than the others. And I adore Cat People. I adore The Leopard Man. This one just like really disturbs me. I've watched it, rewatched it, you know, twice, 2.5 times for this. I think there's just some really, really chilling, you know, elements of it. And it's very different from most other horror movies from the 40s.
And to your point, Cullen, if you'd say Val Lewton to a horror fan, 9 times out of 10, they're going to say, I love Cat People. And that's like it, right? Like that's the movie that everybody knows.
What's the zombie one?
I Walked with a Zombie. That's another famous one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
So I might have picked not the famous one for y'all to start with, but I don't know. That's just my gut said go with something that I really love.
But by the way, Val Lewton did not direct this.
Nope.
No, he was a producer.
Yep. Yeah. But it's still a Val
Lewton
movie.
Was he never a director? Was he always a producer?
To my knowledge, these
are Val Lewton movies because he's a producer of them, not the director.
See, then I'm an idiot because I always, in my memory, I'm like, oh yeah, that's a Val Lewton movie. And then I just immediately went to, he directed it. And then I was a little bit taken aback when he didn't direct this. And I'm like, oh, maybe he never did. Maybe he was just a producerial voice.
I'm going to check if he'd ever. But yeah, the famous Val Lewton movies are him as a producer.
Yeah. Like Cat People he produced.
Well, then did he have a team? Did he have a team that he always worked with to execute his vision?
Yeah, I mean, like Nicholas Musaraka, who's the cinematographer on this, did a lot. DeWitt Bodine, who wrote this one, also worked on Cat People. He worked with Jacques Tenor a lot. It does look like he directed a short film documentary called The Year's Work in 1940. And that seems to be Val Lewton's only work as a director.
But I mean, this is all an RKO thing. And obviously, Val Lewton being, you know, who he came from, you know, David O. Selznick. So Val Lewton is such a, I think he's one of those creative producers, less a line producer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because these movies all have a very similar vibe.
Yeah.
So did Mark, Mark Robson directed this movie. Did he direct others in the Val Lewton oeuvre?
He did, and he also, I think he got his start as an editor, because he edited Cat People, if I remember correctly.
Oh, he did he did a lot. He directed Earthquake. This guy directed Earthquake.
He edited I Walked with a Zombie as well, so.
Oh my God, this guy directed a lot of, he directed Valley of the Dolls.
Yeah, he had a very long career.
Peyton Place. Bridges at Toko Rhee. I'm just reading off IMDb. I don't know any of that.
Cullen, what I find interesting about this movie and the fact that you picked it is, for me, the movie that it evokes the most, just on my, you know, these first two watches again, I really enjoyed it, by the way. This is a fantastic pick because A, I'd never seen a single Val Lewton film. B, this reminded me of some movies that I really like, and now I can watch this movie without watching those movies in some respects. And to your point, the nihilism or the nihilism on screen is, I really appreciate it. Cause you know, nihilism's fun, but this movie reminds me of Rosemary's Baby a lot.
Oh, I totally see that now. Yeah.
And now I don't have to watch Rosemary's Baby. Which is a great film.
No, you do.
Come on. I can't. Polanski is like the one. I'm sorry.
Just do it.
I've seen it, Richard. It's not like I've never seen it. Like.
Oh, I thought you'd
never. No. I've seen Rosemary's Baby, but I don't want to support a convicted child sex offender. It's not like Woody Allen where it's disputed. This is the court said, dude, you're going to jail. Yeah.
You're talking to a man who's sat here for 2.5 hours with you discussing Chinatown within the last 12 months.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I know.
Pardon my chagrin.
I know. Oh, hey, but here's the thing. Again, I had never seen Chinatown, so I had to watch it eventually. I don't know if I'll watch it again is the problem.
This is a prop that y'all should get.
See, look at that.
The Val Lewton Horror Collection. It's not only a box set, it's two box sets that they expanded. When they put a new documentary about.
But, are those DVDs or VHS?
Yes, DVDs.
Laserdisc.
And what are the movies?
It's got basically all the classics. Cat People, Curse of the Cat People, I Walked with a Zombie, The Body Snatcher, Isle of the Dead, Bedlam, Leopard Man, Ghost Ship, Seventh Victim, and then a couple
Isle
documentaries.
The Boris Karloff Isle of the Dead, also directed by Mark Robson. Okay,
yeah, got it. Great movie.
It's all coming together. Okay.
So, did you like The Seventh Victim, Richard?
Did I like it? Yes, I did.
I'm very glad. I was nervous.
Now, but I do, and we're going to get into it, but I want to go back for a second. Now, I began playing Seventh Victim, and it plays with a commentary track.
Sure does.
Now I want to go listen to it on your server, but for a first viewing, I'm like, oh, I'm not, I should not do this. So I'm going to stop that. I'm going to go to Amazon Prime. I'm going to pay my $2.99 and watch it clean, which I did. And now we'll go back because I am very interested in what whoever that was had to say. Because it sounded extremely detailed. Because like the minute the movie starts, it's like the information just starts like a fire hose, and I'm like, okay.
It was probably the thing that it's probably whatever Cullen has. I'm
yeah, I that track probably exists. Cullen, how do you live in the place where you live? Like, what percentage of the space is consumed by DVD media?
There's probably about 6 feet. Tall and like 3-4 feet wide of DVDs right next to me, and there's another shelf over on the other side.
Your wife is happy with that.
Yeah, my girlfriend is okay with this. You haven't seen the You haven't asked about the records in the other room.
I was about to say, Richard, you're not barking up the right tree if you want to talk about the plethora of things that our friend Cullen has.
Or the fact that there's just guitars strewn all over
Cullen.
And if recent events are any indication, there may be broken record players all over the place, too.
Yeah, no, they're finally, I returned
Cullen,
them.
Cullen, when are you going to make this girlfriend an honest woman?
When's she going to make me an honest man?
It's 2021, folks. Cullen's asking the questions that need to be answered.
Who's going to make Cullen Gallagher an honest man? Wow, that's a question. We should just start our own podcast based on that.
And we should start a podcast on how Susan made Richard an honest man.
Oh, my God.
That's true.
Susan pulled my soul out of the gutter, dusted it off. And started ordering it around, and I've never been happier.
Before that, you were like Gene Brooks in this film, just wandering the streets aimlessly with a sullen look on your face.
You know, I mean, this is a great movie in that.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sort of thinking, okay, well, this is a genre film, so we're going down a genre path. So I already know 90% of what's going to happen. I was wrong, and. And it is the kind of movie that I kind of do want to immediately watch again, because at a certain point I'm like, oh, this is not about plot coherency or minute to minute logic or even a sort of a conscious ego level human behavior logic. This is about something else that is harder to define and harder to grasp, and yet it forms a coherent, almost subconscious narrative path that at a certain point I'm like, wait a second, I'm suddenly spinning here. There's a poet, there's a lawyer, there's a what I thought was a creepy psychologist, maybe not. The cult was not what I expected. The sister was not what I expected. The ending was not what I expected, and not because of like giant, crazy, you know, formal plot twists that are meant to. It's just like, wow, this is a tune that I am unfamiliar with, and now I got to listen to it a bunch before I can sing it back to you.
It's pretty fucking high praise.
Yeah, I agree. It's a special little movie, and I mean, Richard, I mean, you're totally right that it has this sort of. Kind of like nightmare logic to it, the way that it flows from scene to scene.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I really like about it is it's almost structured like a mystery film. But I feel like a lot of mysteries, it's like, okay, especially at this time, you'd have like the detective who's sort of tough, who knows what's going on. But you have this young woman whose rug is pulled out from under her. Her sister's gone. She has no family. She doesn't know where the sister is. She has no money. She's in a new city. Everything is kind of frightening around her, but it's all seemingly normal. And I think this movie does a really good job of like making the normal menacing, but still having it have that, like the illusion of like normalcy.
Yeah, because I got to tell you, they do very few things that are overtly designed to unsettle or shock or disturb. In fact, it usually goes the other way. When you're expecting someone to suddenly reveal, it's like, oh, they don't. Like, everyone is sort of, I want to say, playing it straight in a certain way. It pulls punches in a way that is unsettling. People are being reasonable, and yet somehow the movie is unsettling.
One thing that, especially on rewatch for me, that just strikes me as really disturbing is just how nobody is honest with the young woman, this, you know, that's looking for her sister. There's so much kept from her. And these are from the people keeping things from her are the ones she's going to for help. And I think something both she and her sister experience in the movie is there's no one they can go to for help. Like, both sisters have these amazing scenes, one of them on the subway, the other one on the street, and they're like looking around for people, but there's no one they can go to. Yeah. And that sense of like complete isolation is just devastating.
It's I know the scenes you're talking about. There was another scene, man, I just can't even begin to even know how to talk about it. The way it was shot is so amazing. It's the shower scene.
Oh my God, that scene is incredible.
Lord. Yeah.
That image of, you know, you're in the shower, you hear the door open, and you just see this, like, you know, this figure that's just like this shadow talking to you, like menacing. And she's just like frozen there in the shower.
And then, yes. And it's
so violating.
But it doesn't go to a psycho place. It's just a conversation.
No, and then the amazing thing
was when they go to the reverse angle, it's through the shower curtain. You can't see her face either. It's a scene between two people and you never see their faces until the very end when you see her, Mary's face. But to cut to a reverse angle through a shower curtain that reveals nothing is kind of amazing and counterintuitive. And it's
super avant-garde.
It really is. What am I learning here? What is happening? What's the point of all this? And it is a little strange. I mean, it is one of those movies that ends with a feeling of, wow, I don't know how I'm supposed to feel. Am I supposed to feel like that absolute last little scene, which is so strange? It's like, am I supposed to be happy?
That's an understatement.
Am I supposed to be like, am I happy for the woman going out? The sound we hear behind the door, well, we're pretty sure we know what that is. It's like, what? This is a movie. Like, if I'll look on first blush, if someone said, what is this movie about? I would say, this is a movie about, I want to say suicidal ideation, but I also want to say it's about an existential approach to life. It's like they make a big deal of that quote about running toward death and death running toward you. And yet Mary is given really interesting advice throughout the movie. And the advice she is typically given is go live your life. Stop. Don't focus on this thing you're focusing on. Go live your life, up to and including the very first minute of the movie when she's dismissed from school because tuition hasn't been paid. And the assistant comes out and goes, hey, listen, you know what? Don't come back. Actually, I left. I was going to come. I came back temporarily. I've been here 30 years. Don't come back. Go live your life. Go find out what the world has to offer.
And she touches her arm.
But basically, don't be obsessed with death. Okay, because it reminds me of Mothman Prophecies. Check your watches. Mothman Prophecies is about the same thing. It's like, you're either, you know, get busy living or get busy dying. You get either be obsessed with the death mystery or turn away and go live life. Death will meet you sooner or later. I kind of feel like that was the theme or a theme in this movie. What do you think?
I mean, the way I interpreted it is very similar. I took a little starker and darker of a... I just thought that the ultimate theme of the film is the the emptiness with which I feel of my own life is hard to translate to others, and in being unable to do so, I am forever unable to be honest. And that's like, if you think about the Jacqueline character, like, she's really never able, like you said, Richard, able to be honest, and because she is never able to feel honest... or be honest, she feels trapped. And because she feels trapped, like Cullen said, with the isolation, both exterior isolation in the city and her own, clearly her own mindset, I mean, it drives her to this horrible
But honest about what? Because my impression of that character was simply that she was someone who was sort of existentially empty to begin with and then found her place among people who would encourage her down a road of suicidal ideation, hopelessness, and existential despair. But I never felt like she had more to offer. Like I never felt like we were missing something with her. Did I miss something?
I don't know if you missed something. I just think it's a personal interpretation thing. I'm bringing stuff to it that's my own way of reacting to the way that character acts on screen.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Chris, that I think it's... I think she's a really interesting vessel that I think you can read in a lot of ways. I mean, for me, the Jacqueline character, you know, I agree with both of you. I think she, you know, was goth as fuck in, like, kind of, like, idealizing these sort of, you know, doom and gloom things, because she's searching for some sort of meaning, trying to understand something.
Lydia from Beetlejuice.
Huh?
Lydia from Beetlejuice. Think about that character from Beetlejuice, and it's kind of in a similar vein. It's a lot less of a doom and gloom perspective, but the first time she's introduced in that movie, she literally goes, you know, like, this house is haunted, I could live here. She wants to die. She's, you know, wants to kill herself to be on the other side. Like, it's a little bit more of a, you know, not happy, but pop culture-y way, but
it's a goth aesthetic.
It's been about 30 years since I've seen that movie, probably.
Lydia, as played by Winona Ryder, is sort of a goth icon. And it's a little, it's sort of like, I don't want to die. I just want to enjoy images and the notions of death and ghosts and the beyond. She comes to a happy place. Jacqueline is, and I mean, literally, when they're in that room toward the end, and these cult members ultimately are encouraging her to take her own life, and she's so affectless.
I didn't think she was affectless at all.
What did you think?
She looked fucking scared to me.
Oh,
because they're gaslighting her. To me, like, that was the scary thing. Is they're telling her, like, you are as worthless, you know, this is the only way out. You have to die. This is something that you want. And I think that's why she wanted to leave the cult, is because I think she wanted something. She knew this wasn't right. She knew this wasn't the path she wanted to be on. And I think she was just so scared, you know, when they finally let her go, they say, like, okay, you know, they're like, okay, we tried to give you the non-violent way, meaning like, we tried to let you kill yourself, like putting the blame on her. And it's like, well, because you didn't kill yourself, we're going to have to do something for you. It's going to be one of these days, and you don't know when it's going to be. She's walking the streets of New York, and there is someone following her who we think is related to them, but we don't know for sure. And she just goes back to that apartment. She sees that other woman who's dying. I don't know. I just thought, I mean, she really touched me. It was like chilling. I'm just like, this person is just so scared and doesn't know what to do and feels helpless. And so to me, in a weird way, that actually felt really modern and contemporary with, you know, suicide awareness. Just like someone who's at the end of her rope and she can't ask for help. She tried talking to like a doctor who wasn't that good for her,
but
disconnected from her sister, no family, no friends, like...
Okay, we cut back to that scene. We're in that scene three beats. The first beat, I found her sort of like, no. You know, I found her to be affectless. The second time we encountered her, she said no in a more like, don't make me do this way. Then in the third beat, her friend knocks the glass down and says, no, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. She seems to be a person who's like almost like drugged, and she wakes up for a while, but then she falls
back. Because they're gaslighting her. They are literally drugging her. But there's a beat you didn't, or part of that third beat, which is her friend says, you know, don't do this. The only time I felt good was when I was with you.
Which brings me to the gay subtext of this movie. Because boy, that is gay as hell, and I am all for it, because
DeWitt Bodine, the screenwriter, was gay.
Yep. Yeah, that was the thing I was kind of trending towards, Richard. The way I took it was it's very personal, because again, if you can't be honest with yourself and there's no outlet for your honesty, we know about suicide prevention, especially in the
Greenwich Village is also, that's where they go to. That's like, to me, that's like a sign of like, if you're, you know, looking for, you know, a group.
So Chris, go on. Like sort of show me the movie. Show me Jacqueline from that point of view, which is something I didn't pick up on.
I don't think the movie is as overt as I would like for it to be because of the time and era that it's made. I think obviously, Cullen, you would agree, they can't address it the way they maybe wanted to. Obviously, or could, let me put it this way, maybe not the way they wanted to, but the way that they could now.
I agree, But there's also a really interesting parallel, because there's the scene we just were talking about with Jackman and the other woman saying, the only time I felt good was when I was with you. At the beginning, when the assistant says to Mary, like, you know, oh, you know, don't come back. You have to go out there, and touches her arm. To me, that had that almost seemed like an interesting parallel. Like, I kind of got a vibe that there might be something between the two of them. Or maybe that, you know, the woman recognizes something in Mary, like, yeah, you need to, you know, be away from here. This isn't going to be
either
good for you.
You guys are like, your sexual antenna is way bigger than mine. That sounded terrible. Or...
I was like, Richard, wait a second.
Let me show you my sexual antenna.
You guys just have different shaped antennas than mine, huh?
Here's another thing I was going to mention, Chris, about you know, sexuality in this movie. This is one of the rare movies I can think of where, you know, Jacqueline, she gets married. It's a heterosexual marriage.
Right.
That doesn't save her or help her. And she goes to a doctor, and that doesn't help her either.
God.
Like, she goes to these two things, and it doesn't work.
They both
fail. Then because she feels some sort of interior, you know, shame, or like, I must be a bad person because I am different, she falls in with a satanic cult that is all about, she's like, this now, I have now descended to my level of evil. These are the people I clearly deserve to be among. You guys are fucking amazing.
Yeah, well, let's not give ourselves credit for that.
I'm giving you credit, God damn you.
That's okay. You're more than
anytime somebody thinks of something I didn't, I'm impressed.
To Cullen's point, you could call it a coincidence aside from the Greenwich Village thing, aside from the DeWitt Bodine being gay, one of the two screenwriters of the film.
Well, I think
so. It's not one of these, like, oh, it's just a coincidence. Like, no, it's an interesting way of coming at this sideways.
I think Cullen was very clear when he said, that's where those people go, to Greenwich Village. They go. So I think we get what...
You're such an ass, Richard. You're such an ass, Richard.
Yes. They go, you know, they go there.
You know, that's where they go, Richard. Get the fuck out of here.
So.
God damn you, Richard. Wow, Richard.
Even...
Richard's no longer welcome in Greenwich Village.
Even then, it was a place for those people.
Wow.
Look, it's a great place to be.
It would be the equivalent if the movie took place in Los Angeles and they made a big deal of, you know, Hollywood or West Hollywood or something. I would likely make the same connection. I don't know New York, so I don't know the various areas and you know.
Be Dallas and Oak Lawn would be the one for Dallas. That'd be
Oak Lawn. Oh, okay. Yep. Okay.
That's that's, you know.
Okay, so
it's a very popular gay community in Oak Lawn, which is great.
So let's talk about Mary for a second. So then is Mary like, so if this, let's look at it through the lens that has been proposed, that a subtextual element of this story is a person struggling with their own identity and the implications of that
being
identity.
Different, whatever that difference is.
Yeah. Whatever that difference was. I mean, we're talking about a sexual orientation, but it's, since it's not played that way overtly, let's just say that she's struggling with being an outsider. She tries to conform. She gets married and it doesn't really work. And then she goes to a psychologist. Okay, which by the way, at that time was one step away from having yourself committed. So it's like, ooh, you went to a psychologist.
At Bellevue.
Yeah, it's like, what was that conversation about the dipsomania with the secretary? Or it was like, oh, my doctor, you know, my father is actually. Also has a problem. He's like, well, the dipsomaniac, it's rather sordid. You know, I prefer to write about it, not actually treat it. I'll let others treat it. But dipsomania, you know, what the fuck was that about?
He plays that same role in Cat People. It's like it's the same character, so it's...
It's Tom Conway you're talking about, the actor who plays the doctor.
Yeah, I mean, like,
no,
the doctor, like,
no,
that...
No, it's the same doctor.
Oh, yeah. It's the exact same character.
Yeah. That was the that was the one of the things. It's that he's also in Cat People, which is why I'm excited to watch Cat People.
Oh my goodness, that's crazy! I gotta go back and watch all these. You know what?
You should get this fine box set from Warner Brothers. The Val Lewton Horror Collection.
Isn't there just like a closet at Warner Brothers you can go into, Richard, and they just give you free stuff? Come on.
Oh, God, I love you so much.
Don't you like that? The assumption of that is hilarious.
Based on Titans, don't you just get to walk on the lot and walk out with pretty much any part of their library or their memorabilia and with a wink and a nod? Yes, the answer is solid yes.
Thank you. I don't want this vision disturbed.
Right. Just like when people hear like, oh, someone took a prop from the set and like that's a big, they're like, what? They can't just do that? Like, yeah, no shit.
Well, you know, Cullen, I could either buy that and thus, you know, further reify Val Lewton's reputation among Warner Brothers, or I could just have Chris rip me copies or send me packing straight to Plex, and then I could just, you know, fly under a black flag and enjoy it that way. So what do you think?
I thought you were going to say, or you could buy 12 copies of The Mothman Prophecy instead.
Yeah.
Well, one can buy the Mothman Prophecies and the Val Lewton box set.
By the way, and not to bring up Mothman Prophecies again, check your watches.
It's October, guys. You're allowed to, Richard. No one's going to say anything.
Well, it's the beginning. Listen, okay. Now you've uncorked the bottle and the genie has come out.
Go for it.
It is October.
Is this your wand again that you're talking about? Your genie wand?
This is my sexual antenna.
Oh, okay. Jesus Christ.
Good. That's a good band name.
Sexual Antennae. Now opening for Velvet Hammer, Sexual Antennae.
All right. I will say, for anyone within the sound of my voice, so that could be, I mean, tens of people, I want to let you know that October is merely the beginning of Mothman Prophecies season because it is a Halloween film, but also a Christmas film. So basically now through New Year's Eve, you've got a big window to check out The Mothman. That's all I'm going to say. But I'm going to use Shocktober, Christober, Cullentober to make my world into Val Lewton-tober and see more of this because this got me started. I like this vibe and I like it because it didn't sock me in the nuts every 5 seconds. It with tropes. It sort of drove past the trope, pointed at it, and then left. It didn't stop and drag me out of the car and beat the shit out of me at the trope. So the tone of this movie is the king. And again, if you put a gun to my head and said, okay, go make a Val Lewton movie, I'll pay you $10 billion, you have 5 years, I would fail. I don't know how to do it. He's something about these movies. It's nightmare logic without slapping you in the face with it. It's dream logic. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And what's funny is we are now on the third movie of this month that's essentially not a horror movie, and I kind of love it.
What were the first two?
The Strange Vice of Mrs. Ward, which is just a giallo thriller, and then Arachnophobia, which is termed a thrillomedy.
Went back a long ass time ago. I remember liking it though.
That's what the suits at Hollywood Pictures called it, Richard, was a thrillomedy. That was the term they coined for that film.
Well, those people should be buried alive. But that said, I went to see Arachnophobia in the theaters. That was because it was released back in the days when I would just, you know, go see movies. And I was in that movie, and at a certain point, I was like, wait a second. This is a movie about spiders. I don't like spiders. Why am I here? And at that point, it was literally just, okay, now I just have to get through this. And I am not looking forward to it. Because as the movie goes on, I'm going to guess there's going to be more spiders, and then more spiders.
Oof.
And they're real spiders too. They're not. They're not CGI. They're like real.
See, this is a horror movie, Chris. What are you talking about?
But here's the thing: like your personal arachnophobias aside, it is not a horror movie. You know what I mean? Like, if I was scared by spiders, I would agree. But for me, spiders aren't the thing that scares me. I have more existential dread, and unfortunately, I wish I was scared of real terrestrial things. They're rather easy to avoid in that way.
I'm afraid of everything. So.
Okay, so everyone told me, did we talk about that? Everyone's like, oh my God, Paul Greengrass, Flight 93. Oh, you and I talked about this, Chris.
We talked about this on Scary Stories.
We did. Oh my God. Okay, but here's the thing. It's like at that point in my life, I'm like, okay, this is a movie I know not to see because I'm not the best flyer. I have to take a Xanax. I get on a plane. I've got a Xanax. I'm trying to sleep and be unconscious through most of the flight, and it works and it's great and I'm fine. But it's like, oh wait, the movie, you're on a plane and then that plane crashes and that's the end of it. I'm like, and meanwhile, the most horrifying thing in the world is happening to you in the last hour of your life. I'm like, God bless everyone involved in the movie. I don't need to see this movie.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I was thinking about watching it before you mentioned it the last time we talked. But then I was like, I listened to two audiobooks in the month of September about September 11th. I talked about it twice on Scary Stories. I think I'm done for right now.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah. You don't. I mean, again, no one said it was a bad movie. Everyone said it was a really good movie, but that doesn't, in a way, that makes it worse.
Well, and the thing is, coming back to something like The Seventh Victim, I don't necessarily need a movie to annihilate me emotionally every time I watch it.
But my God, what did they say to the studio head? I don't know realistically, maybe they didn't have to say anything. Maybe Val Lewton was super popular and made a lot of money. But how do you explain this movie to anyone as you're making it? And someone's like, I don't get it. What is this movie about? I'm designing the costumes. Can you give me a clue, Val? What does Val say?
I don't know, but I will say that Jacqueline's vibe, that amazing black hair with the straight bangs so high, walking around with just like a fur coat and heels in the village. You see that person around today in New York.
I was about to say, that haircut is out there, brother, in droves.
I love her vibe. I think Jean Peters is fucking fantastic job. Where she doesn't have a lot of dialogue or, you know, action, but just like, I don't know. For me, like, I connected with her character. I think she, I don't know, there seemed to be something kind of like really deep and chilling and touching about her performance.
I agree. It's her performance is haunting, and if you have ever felt the way that she has felt, which I'm sure almost all of us have, you can see in her eyes in certain scenes what she's going for, and if you felt that way before, it's pretty spot on. It is very much like it's like looking into a mirror sometimes and asking the audience to judge yourself before you judge the characters on screen.
Okay, let me ask you this. I want to talk about the poet character and his relationship to the psychologist. And I'm being dead serious when I say I want to talk about it because I don't really have a handle on it. And I want to know what you guys made of it. Why was that in the movie? Not that I don't want it in the movie, but I'm just like, what was the meaning? Why was that important enough to give a lot of time and thought and screen time to that particular? The doctor, okay, so in my recall, the doctor said, you wrote a book and it was very, very popular and you became, it's that sort of New York sort of, you know, whatever. It's like you were the sensation. Now it's been 10 years. You are no longer the sensation. Why are you even trying? And then the guy's like, okay, now that same guy writes something, I guess shows it or gives it to the doctor. And the doctor's like, sort of ambivalent about it. But clearly this has something to do with another approach, another philosophical approach to life.
And also a way to, all three of those guys are trying to control women.
Yeah.
Through different ways. Because even the, you know, the, who actually turns out to be the husband says to Mary, you know, like, okay, I'm not going to treat you like a kid anymore, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to take control. The psychologist is definitely, you know, like sort of helping Jacqueline, but like, locks her up in a room and won't tell anyone where she is. And it's like, I only need cash for her. Like,
what the fuck?
Which is just like kind of creepy. And then the poet is like,
super creepy,
you know, using this like Cyrano de Bergerac metaphor, you know, like, oh, look at this thing in the sky. Look at things through my window. I wrote these poems. I'm a writer. Like, they're all trying to like convince these women that they're all great and that they have to like follow them?
Well, they have Satanists in this film. You also have men who are part of the cult of masculinity. I mean, that's really what it is. That that toxic masculinity shit is on display in this movie. Almost, again, like Cullen said, like three different angles of it.
But in such a weird, passive way. Like, you know, Ward, like, I didn't feel
it's
that
the easiest
Ward...
easiest way to do it.
But I didn't, I started out with worse feelings about Ward and Judd, the doctor, than I ended with. By the end of the movie, I'm like, oh, these guys are less sinister than I thought. Part of your brain is like, okay, it's going to turn out that one of them is obviously involved with the conspiracy. That doesn't go there. And at the end, they're all in their own way trying to help Jacqueline. I did not get a terrible feeling. Like, yeah, it's not great that Ward, who's married to Jessica, is falling in love with his sister, but Jessica's clearly not available.
I agree with you that they're not, you know, totally sinister. And I like the fact that they're not involved with the cult at all.
But aren't they involved in their own cult in a way?
Well, they are. That's what you said. And they're guys. Like, I'm just like, yeah, they're kind of, I don't know. To me, it's just like, yeah, they're guys. Like, they're kind of scummy. They don't really have the women's best interest at heart. They're kind of full of themselves.
Capital M men.
And I think that little moment between the doctor and the poet is this little bit like, okay, yeah, you can show my work to your editors. Fine, I'll show it to you, but don't get your hopes up. I don't think you have it in, like kind of shooting him down again. I don't know. It's just, it's a weird, you see these people that are all kind of together and they're supposedly trying to work towards a common goal, but they're not all trusting each other. I guess that's something that I find interesting about this movie. You come to New York, you meet all these people. This is the network that Mary and Jacqueline have found, but it's not the most comforting network and nurturing. Like, but this is what they have.
They're all out for themselves too.
I don't know. To me, that just like adds to this feeling of like isolation and loneliness.
But okay, I've got a fucking hair up my ass about this poet because I'm like, he was there when you're painting this landscape. You're using the poet color to contrast with the lawyer color. I mean, it's like, okay, you're going to be a poet or a lawyer. Well, we have a poet and we have a lawyer. And we get the feeling that they both like Mary and that they both have very different approaches to life. One very pragmatic, one very sort of romantic. And when I see something like that, I think, well, my brain goes to whoever Mary ends up with says something about her approach to life, what she has learned about how she wants to approach her life. And then she's going to go with one or the other. And she sort of ends up with the lawyer and then the poet sort of nothing happens. I'm still gnawing it.
Well, it's not satisfying. And maybe that's something I like about the movie. I guess that's what I was trying to hint at earlier, where you have this ending and these sort of institutions of like marriage that normally end all Hollywood movies in some way, you know, brings a sense of closure. There is a, you know, union of some sort between Mary and you know, her sister's husband, but like the music doesn't like end on this upbeat, happy chord. The last shot is of this woman walking past another. It's a woman alone who's dying in her room, walks by another woman who kills herself, and you hear the chair fall and the bot, you know, and then she decides to walk out into the night. And it's sort of like a last straw. It's just like, where is this warmth and loneliness and institution of marriage that's supposed to provide the Hollywood ending?
It just smacks you in the face of like, and life goes on.
Yes, and life goes on. Yeah. Because, look, I mean, this character, I mean, again, gets thrown in. I mean, it's just literally, in the last 6 minutes of the movie, Jacqueline meets a woman, and she, you're the woman who lives there. Yes, I'm dying. Let me tell you my approach to death. I'm dying, but there's a part of me that wants to live. I am your opposite. I'm also physically your opposite. You're Jacqueline, you're living and you want to die. I'm dying and I want to live. And at the end, you die, but I put on an evening dress. And even though I am dying, as are we all dying, I'm going to go out to live. I didn't find that disturbing. I actually found Ward and Mary far more depressing, because it was like, yes, Ward, I will marry you. It's all, I know she didn't say that, but it was sort of like, if we're supposed to be happy about that union, that Mary doesn't feel like Mary broke the surface and is now going to live a rewarding life.
Well, and that's the question that the film ultimately asks the audience is, can you find the peace in death that you could not find in life? Because the question that you just asked, Richard, is do Mary and her sister's husband find peace or solace in the arms of one another as they believe they are going to do? That's why one of the reasons they're clearly with one another is because they care about the way the person treats them emotionally. And that's it's a pretty extreme question to be asking in 1943. Like, can you find peace in death? And that's the question that you don't get the answer to it because Jacqueline kills herself and there's no answer past that.
Well,
so the hope is yes.
Somewhere in an alternate universe, there's a podcast going on, and the only thing they're talking about is that this movie came out in 1943 in the middle of a war when people were facing, as a nation, the existential threat of death at a very 400,000. High level. And no end in sight. So in what way did this movie speak to those feelings in a very abstract way, but that's always the most powerful way. That's a whole other conversation that I'm personally not prepared to go into because I'm not smart enough.
Richard, you are smart enough. I think you just summed it up perfectly and eloquently, actually.
Yeah. If you don't want to view it through the lens that Cullen and I were talking about similarly, that's a pretty good lens to view it through.
For a 70-minute movie, I think it's remarkable how many different ways you can read what's going on and the amount of depth that it's achieved.
And to think that this movie started as a film about an orphan caught in a murder plot, and that's where we end up here. It's a complete 180 from where we have this film and this script starting out. So
yeah.
I'm dying to listen to that commentary track.
Yeah, I know. Me too. I know. I'm right there with you. Like, my hope was that I was going to get to watch it three times. But then I realized if I watched the commentary track, I would probably be copying stuff from it that is unfair because it wouldn't be my original idea.
Cullen, under your left hand.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the... That is. Yeah. The, I'm sorry. Okay. So that's the Val Lewton box set. Okay. All right. Yeah. And it's got 9 movies. Okay. Well, like I said, I know what my Shocktober is going to be all about now.
So speaking of that, let's go around the circle. Cullen, Richard, skip it or watch it?
Watch it.
Yeah, definitely watch it many times.
Watch it as well. And you mentioned Shocktober, which is what Mike calls this month over at the Projection Booth. If you've never listened to that show, I kind of had hard to believe, but go listen to that show.
Yeah, it's a great show.
Yes, and Cullen's on there and Richard's been on there as well. I wanted to ask you guys, because we rarely get to, like, you know, not talk about ourselves, but talk about things that we like. Since it is October, and it is the Halloween season, I wanted to ask you both a couple just minor questions about the Halloween season that maybe you've never been asked before. And I want to start, we'll just throw this question out there, and whoever has a more, answer that they're so passionate about, what is the absolute best candy to eat at Halloween? Hey, look at Richard's face. I wanted to get Richard with one he did not expect was coming.
Expect that.
I'm not a big candy person.
Cullen, come.
I'm a pie guy.
Oh man. Okay. Whoa. But here's the question: is there do you like something that you could eat handheld that's not pie that is sweet?
My mom will send me for Christmas like chocolate covered, like pecans. Okay. And that usually lasts, like, a little bag lasts me about 6 months, 6 to 7 months. Actually, wait, I think this year it lasted 8 months.
That's
that wouldn't have lasted
inhuman.
A day in my house.
Cullen,
but, so,
not yeah. Okay. Not okay.
Richard.
Yeah, I'm not a big candy fan, so I feel okay. Ill-equipped to answer this.
Well, I feel very equipped.
Sweet.
Look, the best candy is the 100 grand bar, and there's no question. I will not be taking questions at this time.
Interesting. That's an interesting pick, Richard. That's interesting.
Now, I like candy, and I like candy bars. I'm like, some people are like, oh, the, you know, Hershey's, you know, Special Dark, you know, that's my go-to. And, you know, ooh, Crackle's not as good as, you know, Nestle's Crunch. I like them all. I like the Almond Joy. I like the Mounds, the Baby Ruth, the Milky Way, the Butterfinger, the Three Musketeers, the much maligned Three Musketeers I can enjoy. I can rank them, but there's very few I won't eat.
That's fair. I mean, a candy bar when you're really hungry, there's something about it, right? That just, like a Snickers, if you're really hungry, like it does kind of hit the spot.
Oh, even if you're not hungry, I don't give a shit. There'll be times when I'm like, I'm not hungry, but I know if I have some of this candy, I'm going to want more candy. And that always happens. Chris, what's yours?
I said Mr. Goodbar last time I was asked this question, so I have to say Mr. Goodbar. But if it's not something chocolate, I am a huge fan of just like gummy worms, like sour gummy stuff. I don't know.
What's in a Mr. Goodbar?
Just chocolate and peanuts. It's literally a Hershey's bar with peanuts in it. That sounds so good. It's so simple because it's essentially like an M&M bar. Like that's the way I enjoy it. It scratches that same edge of like a peanut M&M. Like it's kind of in that same wheelhouse.
Now in the neighborhoods, I'm not even sure what I'm asking because Colin, I know you live in New York in a building. I mean, so you have no interaction with trick-or-treaters. Is that correct? Or am I?
Correct. In my old neighborhood, when I lived in Park Slope, you would see kids out in the afternoon and they would mainly go to stores.
I love that.
I think there were some houses that had children that, you know, would make it clear that you could come trick-or-treating there with like decorations. But again, it was like all during the day. And I think people sort of knew what house you could go to. No one ever rang my buzzer. No one ever came to my building there.
Well, you were.
And now I live in an.
Yeah. You weren't laying out the Halloween carpet for them. So they knew, okay, I don't see a little paper ghost. I don't see a bunch of lights. We'll move on. Easier prey.
Yeah.
Statue, nothing in your neighborhood? Kids don't come around? No. Why not? What's the problem?
No, because my neighborhood is a neighborhood where there like aren't a lot of kids, and it's a dead end, like it's a dead end street. It's a weird street that I live on. Let's just put it that way.
Okay.
It's not like a cul-de-sac. It's like if I were to explain it to you, you drive down my street, it dead ends, and then you walk 6 feet and there's another street there and there's more houses there. It's fucking bizarre.
Okay. I think we're talking the same thing. If you picture a suburban street off of a major, like sort of a major thoroughfare, then a street that cuts through a suburb, okay? The minute you turn onto that street, if you hook a very sharp right turn, you go down an angled cul-de-sac, and that's where I live. But you could easily miss it and just go deep into a suburban neighborhood. Here's how Halloween works. People drive to our neighborhood to do their trick-or-treating. They come in from other neighborhoods that aren't as good.
Wow. So you live in one of those neighborhoods.
In one of those neighborhoods. But here's the twist, though, is that they always miss our cul-de-sac. So there might literally be 1,000 kids up and down and up every street and up and down. And we're just this little cul-de-sac that they just don't even look. And it's angled so that even though I decorate my house with lights and stuff, if you stand at the mouth of the cul-de-sac, because it bends, you cannot see my house. And it just looks dark. It looks like, oh, fuck it. Nothing's going on there. Just go down, get the good bread in the middle of the loaf. Don't take the heel, you know? And so we sit there every Halloween with ghost pirates and lights and gravestones and we're looking
and
around.
Richard dressed up like Kolchak in the front lawn.
I'm just as
literally
Kolchak, you know. Or the one year that I told you with the big dark eyebrows and the big mustache, because I'm like, everybody knows Groucho, and anyone who saw me went, Borat.
Holy shit, are you serious? That is amazing.
That's so sad. I'm sorry, dude.
Why you were wearing a fucking black suit? They were like, it just makes sense. Why does Borat. He have a cigar? Why does he have glasses? He's Borat. He's just very confused about what Borat looks like.
Jacques Jumesh.
Yeah, right. Oh my god, that's amazing.
Oh man.
Yeah. So we have a good time on Halloween, and we usually have a couple, you know, some couples over, and you know, I make some Halloween drinks, but we don't get like other streets get. It's just like 3 solid hours, and just you know just. Buckets of candy, just boom, 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 boom. And we're lucky if we get rid of 1 bucket of candy.
So the other question I wanted to ask, and we'll see where this one goes. What is one movie you watch at Halloween? I'm not asking your favorite horror movie or anything like that, because that's too hard of a question. I've realized that that's a bad question to try and ask. What is one or two movies that are in your Halloween rotation every year? And I know the three of us have to have some, given that we are fans of those genres and... I've never asked you, Cullen, but I know Richard and I are fans of Halloween. I would assume you are as well.
The holiday?
Yeah.
No, I love the holiday.
Okay, I'm just making sure.
I love horror movies. I always tend to use Halloween as a time to see horror movies I haven't seen before.
Oh, that's fair.
I don't have a constant rotation this year. We rewatched Haxan, which Lauren hadn't seen before. And it's still a bonkers, bonkers movie. Have you all seen that one?
Is that the one about the haunted VHS tape?
No, it's Benjamin Christensen from 1922. It's a Swedish movie about witchcraft.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, you know the one, Chris. Come on.
No, I actually do know what he's talking about now. Yeah. I got it confused with something else just by the titles being the same. I know exactly what you're talking about, Colin.
I don't, so I am learning.
Oh, it's fascinating. It's like it's told in 7 parts, and the first part is basically research that he did from like old-ass books about like witches and devils going back centuries and like showing pictures of them. So it's like an illustrated lecture. There were program notes where you could see the names of the texts, but then he starts dramatizing and he himself plays the devil with a crazy tongue and it's just wild. And then I just got the new Kino Lorber Blu-ray of Lon Chaney's Hunchback of Notre Dame to watch later this month.
Ooh, nice.
I thought he was going to say Cold Check there for a second.
I was too.
I was waiting for him to be like, and I got this Blu-ray here of Kolchak with and my I'm friends on the...
very excited to hear the commentary track for the Machimoto episode.
I do want to get that Blu-ray, but I'm excited. I like watching silent horror movies at Halloween. That's something
amazing.
I do every year.
Yeah,
I
mean, you can put Rob Zombie or heavy metal or
being the go-to.
Yeah, you can put music on in the background.
Yeah, totally. Got that one.
Yeah. I mean, look, all mine are very obvious. You know, if I had it, you know, a week alone and it was like, okay, every night I've got to watch something, it would be Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Good one.
And then I would easily and happily indulge any Universal horror film. So just, you know, toss those in. But then after that, it would be the movies of my high school years. So it would be Ghostbusters, John Carpenter's mm-hmm. The Thing, American Werewolf mm-hmm. in London. And then with detours to Todd Browning's Freaks, Night of the Living Dead. Yeah. You know, but I mean, again, these are none of these are movies that are like, you know, ooh, that's a hot take. It's like, yes, of course, these are the movies, you know.
I love how you're like, none of these are things that people don't already like. Like, that's okay. You grew up in a time, Richard, where you got to see the shit that we like when it came out. Like, that's mind blowing. I saw Ghostbusters when I was 8. You saw it when you were in high school.
Oh, like, I you saw it at 8. I saw it on a date. You know,
Yeah.
It's a good date movie.
It's a great date movie. Are you kidding?
Especially when Dan Aykroyd gets that
the avalanche ghost blowjob of pussy that I got after that movie. Unbelievable.
All that Jennifer Runyon at the beginning is really what does it. God.
What about you, Chris?
WNUF, Halloween Special, is a good one. That's a movie that is meant to be a found footage VHS of a Halloween special from the late 80s. It is a lot of fun if you've never seen it. It's totally up your alley, Richard.
I gotta see it. That sounds amazing.
It's been on my list. I gotta
WNUF?
Halloween Special. Yep, it's a good one. We did an episode on it a couple years ago. I got to talk with the director, Chris LaMartina. Great guy, great movie. Sequel coming soon. Another thing that I am absolutely obsessed with and watch every Halloween is Ghost Watch.
Oh, that movie is great.
Yeah, Ghost Watch is absolutely one of the greatest, again, found footage kind of real-ish things. Ghost Watch is great.
No, is it scary? Is it funny? Is it, what is it?
It's its own thing.
But is it, that's okay, it. Would Dashiell like it?
Yeah. I'm trying to think what else. Hocus Pocus. My wife brought me around on Hocus Pocus finally. Look, I enjoy it. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I still don't find Bette Midler's performance grating, but I get that that's the point. And Halloween Town. I mean, Halloween Town for me is something that I grew up with.
It's a Disney, I don't know that one.
Disney
that?
Channel original movie.
That's has, why I don't know it.
It has Debbie Reynolds and Kimberly J. Brown Ooh. In it.
Debbie yeah, Reynolds, I'm
Debbie
sold.
Debbie Reynolds in it, right?
Hell yeah.
And Judith Hogue as well. So I'm a huge fan of Judith Hogue as someone who grew up with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So, Halloween. I mean, that's kind of an interesting gamut. I normally try to watch The Exorcist as well. Something you and I will be talking about rather soon, Richard.
Well, we talked around sure. it, but now we're going to talk about it.
About it. But. Okay. And I think for me, the thing that I always do on Halloween is I watch Halloween on Halloween. And that's a good
tradition.
Yeah. And like, it's the one I will tell you that I'm not the biggest fan of Halloween. It doesn't speak to me as a horror fan the way I know it speaks to a lot of people. There are other movies in the oeuvre of slasher that speak to me more than Halloween does. But that's the movie you being me watches on Halloween, and that's just, I don't know, that's the way it is.
You know, a movie I'm really psyched to see this Halloween season, Baby Oopsie,
giving Jess the big shout out.
Yeah, I am so psyched. Well, cause I didn't see the demonic toys for the first time until this past summer, and like we were watching it, and Baby Oopsie was just like such like a fan favorite, and we're like, this fucking rules. And then it turns out that Jess is working on a Baby Oopsie series.
Assistant director on Baby Oopsie. Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. I was like, oh my God, this is perfect. This is the greatest gift for Halloween.
Yeah. I'm super excited to see Baby Oopsie as well.
I was unaware of this.
You have been now made aware.
Baby Oopsie. That's going to be a tough one to get Dashiell to sit down for, but.
Why? It's about a foul-mouthed doll that kills people.
Oh, thank you. That's all the information I need.
What if, if you have a hard time selling your son on that, it's because you didn't describe it the right way, not because it's not geared towards the trauma / just gore hound / weirdo horror fan and all.
Speaking of murdery dolls, and Richard, you mentioned Todd Browning. We also rewatched Devil Doll. Last week.
What is Devil Doll? Is that Todd Browning?
Yeah, from mid-30s with Lionel Barrymore plays a Devil's Island escapee who the guy who helps him escape but passes away figured out a way to shrink people to be miniature doll size, but you can control them with your mind. So, of course, Lionel Barrymore dresses up as a grandma and uses these dolls to get revenge on the associates that, you know, sent him to prison.
Wow. Okay.
What the fuck did you just say?
Sounds pretty dumb.
What did you just, when you said he dresses up like a grandma, I was very confused.
This is Todd Browning. Someone sure. Let this guy make movies.
And the world is a much better place for it.
I love Todd Browning movies. They're twisted and warped.
I don't know. I guess my last question is, do you guys have any Halloween traditions? Like, we kind of talked around it a little bit. You talked about it, Richard.
Yeah, I try to take some time for myself just to stare into the dark sky and communicate with whatever the absolute most mournful, grief-filled part of my soul is, and gives me, if not happiness, a feeling of stability. And then 2 days later is my birthday.
Yes, I was about to say. And then the kicker. What about you, Colin? Any traditions on Halloween?
I normally really look forward to Spectacles Shriek Show, which is their horror marathon at the Spectacle Theater here in Brooklyn. I don't know if they're going to do it this year. Last year they did a virtual one. And this year they haven't announced whether they're doing either in person or virtual. So it just might allow me to catch up on some of the movies from past Shriek Shows that I didn't make, because sometimes it would be like a 12-hour movie marathon, and you might miss one or two. But
I like that name, Shriek Show. It's a good one.
How about you, Chris?
So that's the weird thing. So my wife's birthday is very close to Halloween, similar to yours, Richard. So we kind of just lump it all into its own thing. So normally it's we're celebrating my wife's birthday, and then we watch Halloween, normally cook dinner, hang out at the house. I don't know. It's just try to chill, be chill on Halloween, because, I don't know. I think we all need to be chill.
Yeah.
We all need to chill out. This month, the way this month has been trending, by the end of this month, I hope that, I'm able to still chill out and I've not lost my mind completely. So, what do they say about, I don't want to be one of those people that says it, but Mercury is in retrograde right now. Just gonna say it.
Everyone's good to talking know. About it. Literally, I've heard that 75 times in the last week, and I believe it.
I believe it too. October 18th, by the way.
Thank you. That's when it, okay.
Yup.
Well, that's only another 12 days, you guys. Come on. Who can't?
Right. It's just 2 days shy of 2 weeks. So what could happen in the span of those? Yeah, look at Richard's eyes. Yeah, that's what I thought.
I was told that it what it means is frustrations, roadblocks, you're kind of stuck up to your knees in tar. But what have you heard the meaning of Mercury in retrograde and the effect it will have on you?
I've heard it's just it makes people feel despondent, and you're essentially what you just described. Like, what I have heard is what you just said. Again, I on a recent episode of Scary Stories We Tell, I took astrology to task in a way, and I've come out on the other side more of a believer than I was beforehand. But again, it's also a lot of just it's coincidence and, vagaries and some predictions that could be taken multiple ways because they're open-ended. But at the same time, I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say this October has already presented itself to be not great. So who knows if Mercury being in retrograde means anything?
I will say this. I've never been I'm open to a lot of weird things. And I believe that weird things happen. Astrology has never been my thing. Then I began to read about there were certain people who I, more or less respected in the field of parapsychology and those studies, who started coming out on the side of astrology. And I'm like, oh, come on. I can only go so far. Don't make me back you up on this. However, I will say this. Astrology makes no sense at all. It makes sense and it works and it happens.
Right.
In the same way that paranormal phenomenon makes no sense. None of it makes sense. There is no, in 100 years and in 2000 years, there are still no truly coherent theories as to what's happening, but there's a plethora of evidence that shit is happening. I don't doubt the evidence.
And there are rules to explain all of this stuff, and yet it is impossible to explain. Encounters of the First Kind are how we've characterized this, and it's like, what in the actual fuck are you talking about?
Right. It's like stuff happens, but we do, it is maddening. People have precognitive dreams. They just do. There is no way to explain it. There's no way to create a theory about why or when or how, except that it happens. I think I know it's all anecdotal because they're dreams, people have precognitive dreams that come true.
Yep.
And if you accept that, then you're in a tough philosophical place, because now you're in a place of going, well, the world I live in makes no sense. And a lot of the assumptions I make about the way life must be aren't always true. And that's why most people don't spend a lot of time thinking about this shit, because A, you can't immediately leapfrog to another destination philosophy that it's like, well, you know, the previous paradigm doesn't make sense, but here's how the new one does make sense. And if anyone says the new one does make sense, they're lying, because it doesn't. And then those people are fooling themselves. So now you're like, okay, the only way I can live is with one foot on the dock and one foot on a boat that's moving back and forth and could pull away at any second. That's an unstable place to be. And no one wants to go through the other 99% of their life in that philosophical stance. So you just either A, call it bullshit, or B, just don't think about it and try not to think about it and just go on with your day.
So what you're saying is sometimes shit happens. Someone has to deal with it. Who are you going to call?
Ghostbusters.
Da-da. Da, 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 da. I mean, I don't disagree. I mean, that is the problem with bringing these things up, is the lack of true, quote unquote, evidence of the thing you believe in having any real tangible value. So
it has no value. I mean, that's what's most upsetting, is that it has no value. Yeah. People have precognitive dreams, and they sometimes it helps them. Sometimes they're just meaningless. It's like, oh, I dreamed this was going to happen and then it happened and it's of no consequence. And you can talk about time all you want, but I still have to wake up at a certain hour and be at work at a certain hour. So time works well enough for me.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to assume that because my world that I live in, as far as I can tell, makes 96.4% sense, I'm going to just really, really pray that the other 3.6% doesn't fuck with me too hard.
And if you're part of the people who it has fucked with, it's hard to rationalize the two.
Because their lives are not awesome.
They're not. Boy, we've gone all around the bend, haven't we, gentlemen?
We have.
Halloween, mental psychoses, feeling different. What's not to love?
And we end by going around the bend. It's perfect.
Cullen, where could people find you if they were looking?
You know, I still have that pulp-serenade.com website that I keep saying I'm going to update, but I keep spending my time working on books. I do have, pretty soon, Chris, when you ask me that, I'll be able to say, I have a new album done, but not there yet. Two are in the bag. I might have to re-record a third. But so hopefully some music to share at some point soon.
What about you?
You can catch me on HBO Max's Titans. I'm a writer and executive producer. Season 3 is currently airing, dropping new episodes every Thursday night. Actually, not every Thursday night. Every Thursday morning at 12:01. So basically, if you're a big fan and you want to stay up late on a Wednesday night at midnight, you can watch an episode of Titans. But for the rest of the world, it's basically Thursday. But anyway, it's going great. Critics are loving it. Fans are fucking loving it. We just dropped episode 10, and we have 3 more to go leading to our thrilling episode 13 conclusion. So join us. You can also catch the first 2 seasons of Titans on HBO Max. And if you want to talk to me on Twitter, at Richard Haddam.
You know what else is on HBO Max, Richard? The Sopranos.
How dare you.
Is Rockford Files on HBO Max?
No, Rockford's on Peacock right
Tubi?
Now, I think.
Oh,
I'm just gonna wind up buying the DVD box set later this winter.
I think it's worth it. There's not a ton of extra features, but it's worth it.
I've been doing a complete rewatch of The Rifleman, which I'm on the last season, and I just got to say that it is a very remarkable show.
That's awesome. You know, Cullen, if you love the Rockford Files, there is a podcast where the guys are doing a random order rewatch of Rockford episodes.
Whoa, that's fun.
And they just pick one out of the blue and watch it, and they love the show, and they find things about it and respond to things that it's like, I've seen this episode 7 times, and they're making me see it in a new way. It's called 200 a day, because that's what Rockford charges. So if you want, go check out 200 a day podcast and listen to what they have to say. It's fun.
I'd like to make 200 a day.
Yeah, I'd like to make what a beach bum made in 1974.
Well, and the funny thing is, you talk about the Rockford Files. I don't know if I've mentioned it on a podcast yet that Mike and I are doing that Columbo podcast. So if that's a thing that you're into, Columbo podcast, Chris is never, it should just be called Chris Has Never Seen Columbo, because I have not seen Columbo.
Oh, I think you're going to, I really hope you like it. It's a nice little show.
I mean, I like Peter Falk in everything I've seen him in, so.
Well, then you will like this.
You know, Cullen, $200 in 1974 is like pretty close to $1,000 right now. And yet he was like this, you know, cheap detective living in a, you know, shitty trailer at the beach, charging $200 a day. And like, no one ever blinked an eye. Like he was definitely like low class. But here's the weird thing. If you did a show today about a PI and he said, I charge $1,000 a day, that sounds like a lot. Even if he said, I charge $900 a day, somehow that would feel like, fuck, man. So you can buy another Ferrari? Fuck you. It's weird,
Tom Selleck looking motherfucker.
Yeah, it's like, no, that would be about the same. Anyway, that's all.
I mean, but yeah, because like, I assume people that like work on Wall Street make more than that a day?
Way more.
I can't fathom that. As I said, I still want to, you know, I want to get to the 70s beach bum salary. That's
and I should
mention, maybe one of these days
I should mention, and Richard, I'm going to sing your praises. I have gotten now 2 pieces of fan love. You were the first ever, Richard. Do you realize that?
Before we essentially became friends. You love, yeah.
You said the Monique Marmelstein signed photo that sits in my, so sits great. In my office. But yeah, was sent this today.
Good.
So Wyatt Doyle, who is an artist, sent me a Columbo magnet that says, every day is Columbo Day.
That's amazing.
Is Columbo
just
Day.
Because he heard that we were doing a Columbo podcast. So thank you so much.
And if you like that, and I know you guys intermittently listen to the Gilbert Gottfried podcast, but Kevin Pollak was on recently, who famously does a Peter Falk impression. That's almost how he became famous. Because he can also
I
do
thought
the.
It was his walking.
No, it was because he could do the eye. He would go on Carson and he would talk. He would do the Peter Falk, and he would have one eye steady and the other eye bouncing back and forth.
And wow.
Carson would fall out of his chair. It was amazing. You can probably see it on YouTube. But like a week ago or so, I was listening to that episode, and Kevin Pollak started talking about Alan Arkin, who was Peter Falk's co-star in The In-Laws, greatest movie ever. And he starts telling a story. He's like, well, I knew Alan Arkin and blah, 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 or I know him and blah, blah, blah. And then he starts doing an Alan Arkin impression. And I swear to God, I thought they'd gone to a clip. I'm like,
wow.
Because no one does an Alan Arkin impression. And he started talking like Alan Arkin.
Schmendrick, you mean?
That was good.
But it went on because he was now telling a story about how he got the in-laws going. And he was like, you know, the way Alan tells it. And then he started telling it like Alan. And the story went on for 4 minutes and he never broke. And it never didn't sound like Alan Arkin talking. I almost had to pull over. It was first amazing and then just fucking hilarious because it is exactly Alan Arkin. So I will recommend the Kevin Pollak episode of the Gilbert Gottfried podcast. Specifically, they're all good, but that one for that reason was amazing.
Hey man, Columbo and Kevin Pollak, I guess. I didn't know he could do a Peter Falk. I've only ever
you
seen
should
the
try
Kevin
and get
Pollak.
Him on the, get him to come on the show.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, if we're doing a Columbo podcast, I mean,
you probably could. He went on Astonishing Legends. He knows those guys.
back to the topic at hand. As always, you can follow this podcast at culturecast.com, patreon.com/culturecast is where you can go to donate a dollar. Thank you to all our Patreon supporters. Richard and Cullen, thank you for joining me as always. Cullen, thank you for programming yet another great film. I don't think you have any more for the end of the year, so you knocked them all out of the park.
Oh, thank you. And for this one, thank you, Richard, for suggesting Val Lewton.
Oh,
thank
yeah.
you, thank you. The, we hit the mother load of gold this time out.
I was going to say we could have watched Cat People if we didn't. So yeah, I'm glad we watched The Seventh Victim. And as always, make sure to catch us on the next episode.